2 Timothy chapter 4, and just a single verse to prime our thoughts tonight. This is Paul writing in verse 13. He gives these instructions to Timothy. The cloak that I left at Troas with Carpus, when thou comest, bring with thee, and the books, but especially the parchments. Bring the books, and especially the parchments. Perhaps on those parchments there were letters that he had written, perhaps letters of the other apostles, perhaps some of the gospel writings. Bring the books and especially the parchments. May God bless the reading and hearing of His Word. Well, how many people in here tonight have a personal copy of the Bible? You all have personal copies of the Bible. Well, did you know that we are actually a very privileged generation? In fact, it's only been in the last couple hundred years that it's been possible for individual Christians to own personal copies of the Bible. In the early days of Christianity, many times the copies of the scriptures were held by the elders. There were people who would personally write down parts of the scriptures and take them home to read them and study them. There was a long period of time when very few people had their own actual copies of the Bible. Part of the reason that they didn't have them was because they were expensive. It's estimated that to have enough money to buy a copy of the Bible before 1500, when everything was written out, all the manuscripts were written out in longhand, that it was essentially the same cost as maybe buying a farm to have an entire copy of the Bible. And then, with the invention of the printing press, the Bible was able to be bought. And even then, though, the early Bibles were fairly expensive. So some have suggested that it was the price of having a Bible was essentially that of purchasing a cow. So to have a handwritten copy, to buy a farm, to have a printed copy, early printed copy, it was like buying a cow, and that would have been pretty expensive. Some of the family to buy a milk cow, for example. And so some of the early English Bibles, they put them in churches, and they had to end up chaining them to the lecterns so that people wouldn't take them home. And they would come to the churches, and they didn't have their Bible at home, but they would just stand at a reading lectern and read the Bible. They were hungry to hear the Word of God. Now, it has been said, with the mass publication of books, and particularly now in the new revolution we're going through, the digital age, where you can read the Bible on your phone or look it up on your computer, it has been said that you can get the Bible for essentially what it costs to get a jug of milk. So we went from it costing a farm, to it costing a cow, to it costing a jug of milk. It might even just now be a glass of milk. Free. Yeah. All you got to do is just, yeah, get it for free, for sure. Well, how do we get to this point? God providentially used various historical circumstances to preserve His Word through the years, and He has allowed us to be the beneficiaries of the careful preservation of His Word. This week, we passed a milestone on Tuesday, March the 1st, 500 years ago, in the year 1516, the first printed edition of the Greek New Testament was published. It was called the Novum Instrumentum Omne, or the whole New Testament. And it was, the first printed Greek New Testament. Now, the Bible, we're talking about reading the Bible in English, and there's a story about the old fellow who said, why do you read the Bible in English? And he said, well, if it was good for Paul, it's good for me. You know what I mean? Well, of course, there was no English in Paul's day, right? What language was the Old Testament originally written in? Hebrew. Some small parts in Aramaic. Most of it in Hebrew. And Aramaic is a very similar language to Hebrew. And the parts that are Aramaic are written in the same Hebrew letters. And then the New Testament was written in what language? Greek. For many years, again, before the invention of the printing press, if there were copies of the Bible, it had to be something that was hand-copied. And there were professional scribes who did this, and sometimes people would just, amateurs, would make their own copies. But with the invention of the printing press, it allowed, for the first time, for there to be a standard printed edition of the original language of the Bible, for the Bible to be printed in Greek. So who was the person who did this 500 years ago, this past Tuesday? The person who printed the first Greek New Testament, March 1, 1516, was a man from Holland, and his name was Erasmus. Erasmus was a scholar, and he was what was called a humanist, meaning that he was very studied in the classical languages and in the ancient emphasis upon humanity. It wasn't like secular humanism today. It was a form of what could be called Christian humanism, recognizing the value of human beings as image bearers of God. But Erasmus lived from about the year 1466 till his death in 1536. And I said about 1466 because we really don't know exactly when he was born. He actually gave several different accounts of it himself as to what year he was born. But most of them were 1466, and then he died in 1536. He's often called Erasmus of Rotterdam. Rotterdam was a city in Holland where he was born, although he only lived there for about 4 years. He was born out of wedlock. His father was a Catholic priest named Gerard. And his mother was a woman named Margarita, and her father was a physician. And in those days, as it is still is today, the Roman Catholic priests were not able to marry, but because of much corruption in the church, many of them had essentially common law type wives. And so his father was not married to his mother, although he had two sons by her, and they lived as a family. Erasmus, however, was ashamed his entire life of the circumstances of his birth. And his opponents often threw this up in his face and told him that he was illegitimate. He began school when he's about 9 years old. And in those days, everyone learned Latin. Latin was what was called the lingua franca. And that's a Latin phrase itself. It means the Frankish language. But it's a term that simply means the most spoken language. And it's interesting if you look at the history of the world. As far back as we know, through recorded time, it seems there's always been a lingua franca. If you go way back to the time of the Assyrians, the lingua franca was Aramaic. It was what was spoken in the Assyrian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, and because they were in places like Palestine, it had an influence wherever they ruled. And in fact, most believe that Jesus, his mother tongue was Aramaic. In the Gospels, in Mark 15:34, when he's on the cross and he cries out, Mark records that he said, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which is interpreted, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And there are a couple other places where Jesus says something in Aramaic. When he heals the 12-year-old girl in Mark, it says he said, "Talitha kumi," which is damsel or young girl, I say to you, arise. So Aramaic at one point was the lingua franca. And then Alexander the Great came and he spread Greek culture all over the ancient world. And it's a process called Hellenization, or the Greekification of the ancient world. And that's why our New Testament is written in Greek. Because at that time, if you wanted to travel anywhere in the world, you could get by with Greek. You could go to North Africa, you could go to Italy, you could go to Greece, you could go to what is modern-day Iraq and Iran, which was called Persia. And you could go to Palestine, and your mother tongue might be something else, but you would learn Greek so that you could travel. And that's why the New Testament is written in Greek, because that was the lingua franca of the day. After Greek, the next lingua franca was Latin. And Latin was the language of the Romans. And the Romans spread their culture. And then when you had the first Roman emperor, Constantine, become a Christian, supposedly, you had Latin become the language of the Roman Catholic Church in the Western world. And then it had influence in Europe. And so at the time of Erasmus in the 15th century, in the 16th century, Latin was the language that everyone spoke. Erasmus, his mother tongue was Dutch. But he could travel anywhere and he could communicate in Latin. And also people, if you were a scholar in Germany or in France or in England, you wrote your books in Latin. And no matter what culture people were from, they could read it. By the way, what replaced Latin as the lingua franca? We got our Francophile here. French. Napoleon. His conquest made French, and that's why for a long time, like when Thomas Jefferson in his day, what did everyone want to learn? They wanted to learn French. That was the language of government. It was the language, the international language, what you published in. And then French was replaced by what? English, because of the British Empire and then the United States rising to power, English is now the lingua franca. Do you realize how blessed we are to speak English? We can travel anywhere in the world. You can go anywhere you want to in the world and fly in and step out of the airport and you'll find people know at least a little bit of English. And you'll find many people in just about every culture know a lot. They listen to our music. They watch our movies. It's the language of computers. It's the language of business. And so English is the lingua franca today. But again, in Erasmus's day, it was Latin. And every boy, when you were 9 years old especially, you were sent to school to learn Latin. It was essential that you learn it if you wanted to be successful. Much as children in many other cultures today want to learn English. That's why my daughter's over teaching Ukrainians how to speak English, so they can do well. Well, sadly, when he was still a boy, they also didn't have the modern medicine and vaccinations and things like that that we have today. And there was a disease called the plague, and Erasmus's father died. And then when he was 13 years old, his mother also died, leaving him and his older brother as orphans. And in those days, when you were poor and you didn't have any family, one of the alternatives was to take what they called holy orders and join a Catholic religious organization. If you were a girl, it meant going to a convent, becoming a nun. If you were a boy, it meant going to a monastery and becoming a monk. And if you didn't go because you necessarily had particularly religious convictions or spiritual convictions, you just, in Europe at that time, it's just everybody's considered to be a Christian, and that's where you would go. And so, like many other young people in his situation, Erasmus entered a monastery to escape poverty. And he was even ordained as a priest, a Catholic priest, when he was 25, although he never seemed to have served in a ministerial role and didn't have much interest, really, in being a priest or a minister. I was at this conference last week, and one of the speakers did a talk on Erasmus's spirituality, and he said that Erasmus entered the monastery and became a monk, but his heart wasn't in it. The best thing that he liked best about being a monk was they had a good library. And he was a bookworm, and he liked to read and study. And this speaker drew a contrast between Erasmus and Martin Luther. Martin Luther, the founder of the Protestant Reformation, also, when he was young, entered into a monastery. But he went to the monastery because he was very worried about his soul. He was worried about the wrath of God. And the speaker said, Luther went into the monastery to save his soul. Erasmus went in to enlighten his mind. He wanted to read and study. What did he look like? According to an early biographer who was his friend, he had a fair complexion and bluish-gray eyes. He was winsome, reticent, a brilliant conversationalist. He had arched eyebrows. I like that, Chloe. And a wry smile. And he had a delicate, she can do a good raised eyebrow. He had a delicate constitution. Well, again, he didn't particularly want to be a monk, and an opportunity opened for him to be, because he knew Latin well and excelled at it, to become the secretary to a bishop. And a bishop was a person who had some importance in the Roman Catholic Church structure. He was over many churches. And this bishop eventually allowed him to go to the University of Paris, where he studied in the Collège de Montaigu, the same school where John Calvin would eventually study. It was here that his gifts as a scholar flourished. In 1506, he discovered and published a work that was just lying around in a monastery by an Italian humanist named Lorenzo Valla. And it was his annotations on the Bible that had never been published. And he edited them and published them, and it also introduced him to the study of the Bible. Valla was famous because he had debunked a papal document called the Donation of Constantine and exposed it as a forgery. And from Lorenzo Valla, Erasmus also learned the importance of textual study, studying the text and proving the history of something that's written. In around the year 1510, he went to England. And he taught at Cambridge University from around 1510 to 1515. Remember, he speaks no English. He lives there for 5 years, but all the lessons were taught in Latin. All the communication was in Latin. And he lived there for 5 years and never really learned English. He got to know the famous Catholic scholar Thomas More there. I think it was Thomas More's wife who complained. She didn't know much Latin and he didn't know any English. And she complained that all the time he was there, he didn't really learn much English because he relied on his Latin. Well, while he was there, he heard an English scholar named John Collett lecture on Paul's writings. And he didn't know much about the New Testament, but he heard this lecture on Paul's writings. And it made him even more interested in the New Testament, and especially in wanting to learn Greek. Now, very few people in that time knew Greek. It was almost a lost language. The Bible had been translated into Latin in the 4th century by a man named Jerome. And that translation became known as the Latin Vulgate. And it was the main Bible that people used. And for literally centuries, no one in Western Europe could read Hebrew or Greek. Now, there's a city, Constantinople, which was the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire. And the Muslims came in and attacked and destroyed the city in 1453. And lots of people from Constantinople fled into Western Europe. And they brought with them many of the Greek manuscripts of the New Testament that they were still using in the Eastern Church. And there were also people who came who knew Greek. And so all of a sudden, this added to what we call the Renaissance. People were reading not only Christian texts, but also pagan texts in the original languages. And Erasmus in particular said, he had a hunger. I want to learn, I know Latin, I want to learn Greek. And I particularly want to know it because I want to know the original language that the Bible was written in. And he's interested in textual study. And so he learned Greek and mastered Greek. And then you had the invention of the printing press in the 1440s or so. And he got together some Greek manuscripts. We're not sure exactly how many he actually had. He left England. He went to Basel, Switzerland, where he knew a man named Froben, who was a printer. And he collected these manuscripts, and they put together this first printed edition of the Greek New Testament. Now, actually, in that work, on one side there's Greek. On the other side, he put his own Latin translation. Some people believe he was actually more concerned about his own Latin translation because he wanted to correct. He was also an expert in Jerome and the Vulgate, and he wanted to correct what he felt like were mistakes in the Latin Vulgate. But to prop up his new Latin translation, he put this Greek text. And as it ended up, no one remembers his Latin translation, but everybody remembers the Greek translation. It was the first time people, again, could read the New Testament. It could be widely disseminated. Also, it could be one copy, a standardized printed copy. I was talking to somebody about this earlier. There have only been, really, since the time of Jesus and the apostles, there have been two revolutions in technology that have deeply affected the transmission of the Bible. The first was the invention of the printing press. For the first 1,500 years, not just the Bible, but everything had to be hand-copied. And then we had the invention of the printing press, so all of a sudden you can have hundreds, thousands of copies of something. It can be in a standard form. You can come up with a first edition. If there are mistakes in it, you can correct them, come up with a second edition, and so forth. The second major revolution is what? The digital. We're living in it right now. We are living in the midst of, if you're unaware of yourself, I wish I could live in great times. You're living in the middle of it right now. A lot of people wonder whether even a few decades from now, whether anyone will even have a print copy of the Bible. Will it be all digital? All of our written information may be digital a few decades from now.
We may only see these in museums. I hope that doesn't happen because I love books. Not worried about it, though, because God is sovereign. And he was sovereign during the time of Erasmus, when there was this transition from the handwritten copies to the printed editions. Well, there ended up being 5 editions of this Erasmus New Testament that came out in his lifetime. One in 1516, 1519, 1522, 1527, and 1535. The third edition is best known by some for being the first Greek New Testament to include a passage that was controversial. It was not included in his first 2 editions, but he added it in 3rd and later ones, and it's called the Coma Johanneum, 1 John 5, the second half of verse 7 and the first half of verse 8. That refers to 3 heavenly witnesses. Well, this printed Greek New Testament, 500 years ago this week, it was this Greek New Testament that the Protestant reformers took and they studied, and from this they created the first vernacular translations, modern translations. Martin Luther in Germany used Erasmus's Greek New Testament to publish in 1522 the first German New Testament. William Tyndale in 1525 used Erasmus to publish the first English New Testament. And what did Tyndale get for his troubles? He was put to death for that. And what were his last words as they were recorded? Lord, open the King of England's eyes. And within a few years, in fact, the king was ordering the publication of English Bibles. But it would take several decades after Tyndale's death. So this Erasmus's Greek New Testament had a huge impact. In fact, some said this. They said Erasmus laid the egg that Luther hatched. Now this year, not many people are recognizing it, but this is the 500th anniversary of Erasmus's Greek New Testament. Guess what happens in 2017? 500th year of the Protestant Reformation. So Erasmus comes out with his Greek New Testament, March 1, 1516. Go forward to October 31, 1517, and Martin Luther goes to the door of the church in Wittenberg, Germany, and nails to the door his 95 theses, his 95 protests against abuses in the Roman Catholic Church. Medieval Roman Catholic Church, and his protest begins the Protestant movement, an attempt to purify the church, attempt to restore justification by faith, the authority of the Bible, the regulating worship by the scriptures. And so, again, Erasmus laid the egg that Luther hatched. Now, unfortunately, although Erasmus was a critic of the Catholic Church, he wrote a book called The Praise of Folly. He often ridiculed things like excesses and debauchery in the clergy and greed and so forth. He never left the Roman Catholic Church. He never joined with the reformers. And in fact, he was critical of them. In 1524, he wrote a treatise on free will criticizing Martin Luther. And Luther responded with perhaps his most famous work that's titled On the Bondage of the Will. Luther said, yes, Erasmus, we have free will. Yes, we have free will. The only problem is our will is in bondage to sin. And so our will is free, but it's been corrupted by sin so that apart from the regenerating work of Christ,
we're bent towards doing that which is not pleasing to God, unless He changes us. Erasmus, again, at the end of his life, was living in a kind of no man's land. He was disliked by the Protestants because he wouldn't come over to the Reformation fully. He was also under suspicion by the Catholics because he had printed this New Testament in particular that the Reformers had taken and used. And at the end of his life, was in this no man's land. He died unexpectedly while on a visit to Basel, the city where his Greek New Testament was printed. And it is said that his last words were not in Latin, interestingly enough, but in his mother tongue, in Dutch. He said, "Liebe God, dear God." Like I said, I listened to a church historian give a presentation on Erasmus last week in Houston. And when it got to the Q&A time, my question for him was, do you think Erasmus was really converted? Do you think he was really regenerate? And he was arguing that he was. But that's still something that's debated. It's hard with Erasmus. Was he ever really converted? He doesn't speak much about the biblical gospel, I think, as it would be articulated by men like Luther and Calvin. In many ways, Christianity was more of a cultural thing for him. And, we don't know. We're not his judge. But one of the things we do know is that God used this man. And God used this man as an instrument in his hand, as he uses all men. When we despair around us and we wonder why things happen in politics or in culture or whatever, we're reminded that God's hand is at the wheel of history. And we'll never know, really. It'll be, if Christ tarries, generations come, we'll see how God may have providentially used different persons to ends that are unknown, that are mysterious to us.